You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report says Wisconsin needs to do more in order to close racial disparities in the state's higher education system. We'll talk to one of the authors of that report in just a bit. First, a New York Times investigation traces Donald Trump's financial history and challenges the story he told on the campaign trail. The investigation finds that Donald Trump received hundreds of millions of dollars from his father over the years, and that much of that money was passed on in ways aimed at skirting tax laws. The story draws on interviews with former employees of Fred Trump, Donald Trump's late father, as well as 100,000 pages of documents, all of which detail the strategies the Trump family used to avoid millions of dollars in taxes. Russ Buettner is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He was one of the reporters who broke this story. Russ, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the details, take us into how you and your colleagues got into the story. Where did the trail start for you?
I guess it started originally during the 2016 campaign. We were each working on various aspects of Mr. Trump's business background. And then one day in September, one of my colleagues on this story, Sue Craig, received three pages from Donald Trump's tax return from 1995 that showed he had accumulated about $1 billion in business losses that was allowing him to write off all the income he made for like another 18 years after that. And we continued on that path. And then in 2017, in March of that year, one day on Rachel Maddow's show, she said she'd obtained some of his tax returns from 2005, which showed by then he was making some income. And so we just started wondering what had changed and became, through that kind of exercise, enthralled with the empire that his father had built and that the family had sold off just the year before that return. And we're off on sort of a road that we didn't expect that that lasted the last year and a half.
So a year and a half, 100,000 pages of documents later. Let's get into some of the takeaways here. Donald Trump on the campaign trail had told a story. He'd gotten a $1 million loan with interest from his father, Fred Trump, and that's what he built his empire on. What, as you came to the conclusion here, what did Donald Trump get from his father over the years?
What we were able to tabulate in current dollars was about $413 million, and that money began flowing to him when he was just 3 years old, accelerated during the years, and accelerated greatly during the years when he was in financial duress himself.
Right. $200,000 a year, I don't know if it's considered a salary, but starting at age three, is that right?
That's right. His father was very ingenious at finding ways, many of which were totally legal, just very crafty, to begin funneling his wealth to his children when Fred Trump was still a relatively young man. And in that case, he had just built his first two very large apartment complexes in Brooklyn, and he gave the land under those apartment buildings to trusts that were for the benefit of his children, including Donald Trump, and then began paying them rent. So in effect, he made his children his landlords when Donald Trump was 3 years old. And that $200,000 a year in rent that he was paying, that was Donald Trump's share of that, was about the equivalent of the average physician's salary in the United States of America in 1949.
Talking to Russ Buettner from the New York Times, one of a team of reporters who broke a big story looking at Donald Trump and his family's financial history. Russ, I want to dig into one particular angle here that you and your colleagues followed, the all-county building supply and maintenance. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. It's one of the most fascinating things to us that we saw. Fred Trump ran this huge real estate empire of about, at the time, 10,000 apartment units in New York City, had almost no debt at all, and it was just kicking off tremendous profits. And 1 year alone, 1990, he paid himself $50 million. That's a big chunk of change. And he wanted to start finding ways to get those profits to his children so he wouldn't have to pay estate taxes on it when he eventually passed away, but he also didn't want to pay gift taxes on it. And All County was an early way that they found to do that. It existed only on paper. It had no employees, no offices, no warehouses. But what happened was when Fred Trump negotiated things, the prices for things he would buy, like boilers or roofs or cleaning supplies, he would have one of his employees write an invoice for that from this entity that existed only on paper, All County Building and Supply. And then All County would bill him, this is again happening all with his employees, bill him for 20 to 50% more. And then the difference there, the padded invoice amount, would just get split between his children and a cousin who were the owners of all county. So it was just an invoice padding operation that allowed him to funnel what became millions of dollars a year, in essence, his profits to his children without paying any gift taxes on it.
And there was a follow-on from that. A lot of these apartments in New York's convoluted laws, they were rent-controlled, and you could justify increasing the rent, if I have this right, if you show that you were paying more money. So those higher rates from all county, what happened to renters then because of those?
Well, that's exactly right. When one way that landlords can increase the rent in New York City on their rent-regulated apartments is to say, look, we put a new kitchen in this unit. It cost us $1,000. And so then you can get a rent increase that's some percentage of that amount that you spent on the unit. But they were submitting these padded invoices from all counties. So when they would spend $1,000, they would ask for a rent increase based on the $1,200 that included the pad amount that got split between the kids. And so for that decade and since, these apartments, the tenants in them incurred a bigger rent increase than they would otherwise, just so the Trump children could have some more of their father's money.
Another path that you found of wealth transfer, basically from Fred Trump to Donald Trump and other children, has to do with changing the way properties were valued. Again, kind of complicated, but things might be one value here and then sold for much more. Can you tease out how that worked for us?
Yeah, it's a complicated transaction. It occurred in something called a grantor retained annuity trust, which I think very few people actually really want to know about, but it's set up as a way that wealthy people can transfer their assets to their children without having to pay the estate tax. And it's very beneficial just in the way it's set up and the way that the IRS endorses it. The Trumps pushed that beyond any recognition. The first part of the process in doing one of these trusts, in this case in real estate, is to get an appraisal of the property. So they got an appraiser who came in and gave them a number for all the properties. They seemed to be grossly low. In one case, there was a two-building apartment project with 1,000 units that the appraiser valued at a negative $5.9 million. The project had just gone through some renovations. It was coming out of an affordable housing program, so rents were going up. And the city at that time said the properties were worth $40 million for property tax purposes. So the idea that it was Fred Trump would have to pay somebody to take it off his hands was kind of absurd. These buildings, they ultimately were able to value at just $41 million, and after a few years, they sold them for 16 times that amount. So they were able to avoid an astronomical gift tax bill through this very aggressive posture they took with valuations.
One big question is whether any of this was illegal as opposed to just skirting the law. You talked to some financial and legal experts about that question. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, the what we were talking about with all county, where they're both evading a gift tax and then also filing documents that appear to be fraudulent with the state. Former prosecutors we talked to all said universally that's just hands down illegal. It looks like a tax evasion charge would have been a potential, and then filing false documents with the state could have been another way that could have fallen into the criminal realm. There are other things that are a little fuzzier. In some of the cases about the trust that we were talking about, the valuations, they would have to show that those were fraudulent, that they withheld information from either the appraiser or from the IRS. The people that we spoke to and showed these things to said it definitely looks like they were playing games with valuations. We see other instances where they got appraisals that were ridiculously high, for instance, when Fred Trump was making a charitable donation, and in this case, they're ridiculously low, and that all of that together could add up to some sort of fraud. But it's important to note that the statute of limitations on any possible criminal charges has long since told, but there is some exposure they would still have to civil penalties, paying back taxes and fines.
Talking to Russ Buettner from the New York Times about an in-depth investigative report on Donald Trump's finances and that of his family, the amount of family money he received over the years, and possible violations of tax law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Excuse me. What do you think about what you're hearing about this investigation? Does it affect how you think about President Trump? Do you think this is something that Congress should investigate? Are you wondering what's in more recent tax filings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about a New York Times investigation that raises question about President Trump's tax practices and that of his family. We're talking to Russ Buettner, one of the reporters who helped uncover this story. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the investigation and its findings? What do you think it means about Donald Trump? Are you curious about his more recent tax filings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Russ, in your piece, aside from the financial and legal stuff, you also tell a story of Fred Trump kind of grooming Donald Trump to be this dashing young out-of-nowhere figure on the New York real estate scene and the media really eating it up. Talk about that story.
It's, it's one of the amazing parts of his, how different he is from his father, and then how he came to have this outsized place, first in New York's kind of media life and then nationally and internationally. His father was an underspoken man, didn't generally put his name on his buildings, kept a low profile, didn't build flashy buildings, and stuck to what New York City we call the outer boroughs of Brooklyn and Queens is where he worked in Staten Island. But he was always looking for a successor in his children. And Donald Trump was very clearly, even though he was not the oldest son, the one who emerged to fill that role. And was very different, and obviously very different, from an early age. He drew attention to himself in any ways that he could. One of the most interesting things to us was to find articles from the 70s where Donald Trump is talking about his projects, the things he's built, the things he owns, to reporters. And actually, he's taking them on a tour of buildings that his father built and his father owns, and Donald Trump at that time did not own at all. And he began to sort of appropriate his father's wealth to build his public persona. And although his father was very different, he really seemed to admire that showmanship in Donald and that he could make things happen through that being the showman that he was.
Let's go to one of our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jason is with us in Milwaukee. Jason, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I'm just wanted to make a comment that as a Trump supporter, someone who voted for him, that sort of had this in the back of our minds that there would be nothing because he actually won, that there would be nothing but these continued investigations. You know, we have Russian collusion that's turned out to be nothing thus yet. This is just yet another thing that kind of has sour grapes written all over it from the other side, and it's really getting old. So just wanted to make that comment.
Jason, thanks for the call. Jason, not alone. Similar things have been said in the Republican world. Russ, why bother at this point? The election's long gone. Why keep digging into the Trump family's finances?
Yeah, we're not trying to change an election. I mean, this is a process that anyone enters public life goes through. There's a way they represent themselves to the people, and usually the campaign process is a little bit longer. In Donald Trump's case, it was very short. And we're going to continue to look at things that explain his long life in business and how he's represented that before he ever came into a public life. Usually, by the time someone runs for president, they've run for governor, senator, or whatever else, and they've been sort of vetted in that way and their life story has been looked at. Donald Trump, that's just not the case. He was a television personality and a kind of an interesting, charismatic figure that people didn't take seriously on this level. So this is a usual sort of process that he's going to go through and that historians will continue to review now for decades to come.
Jason, thanks for that call. Yeah, the all-county building supply and maintenance that we were talking about earlier, as far as you all could tell, that's the first reporting on that. That was the first you had heard of it. It was new to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's never been mentioned publicly before. That's right. And neither has the trust or the Trump Palace investment thing that we mentioned in there. All of this was totally new.
Now, there's a lot we don't know. You mentioned a couple of dribs and drabs of information about some more recent tax filings. What don't we have from President Trump that we might have had from most other presidential candidates in recent years?
Well, every presidential candidate for the last 40 years for the major parties has released all of their recent tax returns under the idea that people should be able to see what are the sources of their income and that people should be able to determine for themselves whether that represents any conflicts with the actions that they might be taking. Donald Trump just chose not to do that. First said that it was because he was under audit, although he's never shown that there were actually audits taking place. And he's rejected any notion that some of those audits from the 90s or the early 2000s must be complete by now, and he could release those. And he's just sort of maintained this hardened position on that.
Let's go to another caller now. Jack is with us in Chippewa Falls. Jack, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Jack?
Well, I guess what I'm thinking is the populist candidate that we put in, and I guess we're all responsible, has really pulled the wool over our eyes with multiple bankruptcies, tax evasion from what we're hearing here today. This is the guy that runs as a populist apparently has fooled a lot of people.
All right, Jack, thanks for calling in. Let's talk a little bit about the bankruptcies. Russ, another angle in this story is when Donald Trump's business enterprises had run into hard times, sometimes they're helped, bailed out by, again, Fred Trump. Can you talk about how that happened?
Sure. Certainly the darkest years in Donald Trump's financial existence were right around 1990. He had bought a bunch of high-profile assets, a prominent New York hotel. He had built very expensive casinos. He had bought a yacht from a Saudi prince. And he did this with extraordinary levels of debt that the enterprises couldn't support. And by 1990, it was all collapsing around him. Some of his lenders were threatening to force him into bankruptcy and to foreclose and take all these properties and assets away. At that point in time, the support from his father increased greatly. His father also started paying himself much more. And we wonder if other amounts of that money went to Mr. Trump that we haven't found yet. But one example was, I think I mentioned it earlier, was an investment that Fred Trump made in Trump Palace, an apartment project that Donald Trump was building at the time. In 1987, Donald Trump owed his father more than $15 million, and they converted that first $15 million into an investment in the Trump Palace apartment building that I mentioned. And then 4 years later, his father sold those shares back to his son for $10,000, coincidentally a week after Donald Trump had received his $10,000 Christmas check from his father. So that basically was a gift of $15 million right at his son's darkest hour. And then to complicate it and to take a move that we've been told is illegal, Fred Trump then wrote that off, that $15 million off as an investment loss on his income taxes, which saved him about $5 million in income taxes. And we're told that those they're called related party transactions, are not legal.
And one weird story, a representative of Fred Trump going into a New Jersey casino buying millions of dollars worth of chips and not placing a bet?
That's a great one, too. Yes, that was Donald Trump on that week was going to have to make a payment on his bonds, his loans, in order to keep his casinos, and he didn't have the money for it. His father sent in a loyal aide to buy $3.5 million in gambling chips, and just put him back in the car and drive back to Queens. Ultimately, the authorities figured out that that was what had happened and that that was an illegal loan, and Fred Trump years later was required to cash those chips back in. But it certainly got his son over the hump on that given day.
Let's bring on one more caller. Mike is with us in Trempealeau. Mike, hello.
Yes, just had a question for your guest today. You know, he's talked about the investigation they did as far as the taxes and stuff. Did they go beyond just the Trump end of that? Because to be able to accomplish these activities, there had to be others involved as far as the person that set the values, you know, incorrectly on the buildings. And, you know, the fact that even though these things sound very blatant, apparently the tax officials didn't bother to look at it. So, I mean, was this lax government? Was this corruption? What allowed all this to happen?
Mike, thanks. Russ?
Sure, it's a good question, Mike. Thanks. In some cases, there's no indication that the taxing authorities looked at these things. We were talking about All County earlier, the Trump Palace investment loss write-off. There's no hint that we see in the tax returns that we have that the IRS was aware of anything untoward there or what the actual mechanics were of what was transpiring there. In the case of the trust we were talking about and the valuations, the IRS did look at it. They did come back and say, these valuations are too low, and they required the Trumps to pay, I believe it was about, in that case, $5 million more in taxes. But that was nowhere near the actual undervaluation that it appears that they missed. We're told by very prominent trust and estate attorneys that we've consulted on this, that that's very common, that the IRS is typically very outgunned on these large, complex returns, that they don't hire their own appraisers generally to go out and look and see what the properties were really worth. They just sort of say, this seems low, and if they can get $5 million more, they would call that a win. And our trust and estate attorneys we talked to said that's a normal posture for them, and most likely the Trumps happily signed that check, realizing that they had saved tens of millions of dollars had the IRS actually been a little more diligent in the process.
We'll leave it there for now, Russ. That's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Russ Buettner of the New York Times talking about an in-depth report on Donald Trump and his family's finances. You can read that report on the New York Times website. Now, high school graduating classes in Wisconsin are becoming more diverse over the years. In the year 2000, 10% of high school graduates were students of color. In 2016, that rate rose to 22%. But as these students head to college, some of them, there are challenges awaiting them on campus. A new report from the nonprofit think tank COWS found that public colleges and universities in Wisconsin need to continue reducing ethnic and racial disparities on campuses across the state. Disparities range from a lack of support for students of color, lower graduation rates, and more. Our next guest is a co-author of that new report. Matthew Browngen is a senior associate at COWS, a nonprofit think tank based at UW-Madison. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with that high school graduating class. What are the numbers when we look at the ethnic and racial breakdown when they graduate, and how many of them go into our colleges here?
Yeah, so this actually might be one of the biggest key findings that we have within this. You know, so as you said, you know, graduation rates, particularly graduation students coming from Wisconsin high schools, is increasing when it comes to students of color. When this directly plays, particularly through UW Systems and WTCS, what we've seen is actually less students coming from Wisconsin going to UW Systems. With WTCS, is far more representative, is actually pretty representative when it comes to students of color within Wisconsin, partly because, you know, it's going to be more than just high school students, recent high school graduates, wide range, but also the last 10 years since the recession has pretty much gone away, of sorts, depending on wages, you know, enrollment has dropped because of that, as technical colleges tend to serve throughout. But when it comes to UW Systems, four-year institutions, we've seen a decrease, really, as students of color enrolling into these schools, and that's troubling.
Now, we've talked a lot on this show and elsewhere about racial disparities in educational outcomes in our schools, you know, K through 12 schools in Wisconsin. And when you think about disparities at the college level, you might think, okay, that's just following on from that. But if I'm reading this report right, it even gets a little worse at that stage. It isn't just what's happening in K through 12.
Right, right. So as we highlight in our report, particularly when it comes to economic access, and this is really where access and graduation rates to UW systems as well as even WTCS really play a role, is students with a high school, let me make sure I get this exactly right, diploma. Where is this? But basically, with students with a high school diploma and students with some college are going to have basically equivalent wages. This jumps up quite a bit after students get a four-year degree or a two-year degree, which really highlights this. As we see with, again, highlighting and really kind of staying on UW systems when it comes to enrollment, share of total Wisconsin students entering into UW systems, white students is at 40%. It was around 39% in 2000. When it comes to black students, it's 23% in 2000. Right now, it's 14%. In 2016, enrollment class was 14%. Latino students, 29% in 2000, down to 26%. This is, you know, again, we're seeing this decrease. White students has pretty much seen this stay the same. Then when it transfers into graduation, since we're seeing less access, UW-Madison, for example, has actually seen an increase in graduation rate across the board. UW-Madison has done a great job. I really want to highlight that when it comes to graduating students across the board and have done a great job closing graduation disparities. Not quite closed yet between students of color, but we've also seen them, since they're bringing less students from Wisconsin come in, that those rates are going to be small. So we're still seeing around 90 to a little over 100 students, depending year to year, black students graduating from UW-Madison, even though the graduation rate has gone up.
I want to highlight that first point you made there, because it seems like that's one of the big takeaways from this report. The percentage of black high school graduates going to college here in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Was already low compared to white students, and it's gone down significantly.
Yes.
So that seems to be a big starting point, and that'll take us into some of your recommendations. We're talking to Matthew Browngen from the group COWS, looking at racial and ethnic disparities in higher education here in Wisconsin. So let's start with that worsening gap in terms of the number of high school students of color, black students in particular, going into our colleges here. What kind of things do you think, and you talked about this in the report, what kind of things could help turn that around?
Yeah. So one of the biggest things, and actually I wish we put it in the report that came to my mind after we published it, was getting rid of access tests. So you think of like ACT, SAT, which is not too, you know, when you look at holistically, aren't indicative of really performance. It's more so indicative of how well you take those specific tests and all sorts of cultural things. So that's something that isn't in it that is a big thing. But when it comes to, again, continuing throughout that, pre-college programs have shown to work quite a bit across the country, and it's definitely one of the things that we recommend continuing investment in that. I do want to say all of our recommendations are really contingent on the state of Wisconsin reinvesting in these public institutions. They have to have the resources to be able to spend on recruiting and bringing in and preparing students for their universities.
Yeah, that's a point you and your co-authors made in the report. These problems are at UW and to a lesser extent the technical college system. They aren't problems that were necessarily caused by those schools.
Right, right. And even then, you know, some of this is definitely things that is even within their hands. Granted, you know, as we've seen a decline within our K-12 system, that's going to impact students coming into these schools. But at the same time, when they get here, that's on the schools. Again, they still have to have the resources to help these students to hire more student advisors and culturally competent advisors to help create cultural centers and to help students feel welcome on a campus. One of the biggest things we've seen of why students end up transferring out, particularly at UW-Madison, or leaving, or even post-graduation, as we see with a brain drain of students of color on campus, is that feeling of being welcome or not? And the creation of dedicated spaces for students of color and culturally competent spaces and advisors and professors that look like them, that have diverse backgrounds, help create a welcoming atmosphere, as well as at times even more of a enhanced syllabus for classes.
So one point you make in the report, I'm paraphrasing loosely here, you make the case that if the goal is to increase attendance rates and graduation rates for students of color, there have to be not colorblind policies. They have to reach out directly to, in this case, African-American students.
Absolutely. You can't undo years of targeted and purposeful racialized and ethnic oppression with colorblind policies. The only way to undo these types of policies and the legacy impact and ongoing impact and ongoing practices is through targeted policies and actions that undo, that purposely undo racialized and ethnic oppression.
Another recommendation in the report is more on the economics of college. Often students of color are from lower income backgrounds. Can you talk about what you'd be looking for there?
Yeah, so again, I do want to give MATC and UW-Madison a shout out with, you know, they have the Badger Promise, and MATC has tuition promises for students. This is huge. When it comes to those tuition costs, and helping students come to these institutions really goes a long way in increasing access as well as graduation. College costs a lot. You can, back in the day, you know, my dad could you know, go work for a summer and pay his tuition. You can't do that anymore. So this absolutely helps students that are going to be disproportionately students of color as well as coming from low-income backgrounds. But the costs of college do not stop at tuition. And one of the biggest obstacles that we've seen is housing security and food security. 36% of students nationally are housing insecure. Another 36% are food insecure. We know these things have a direct causation and correlation with how you perform in school. And if you actually can maintain attendance throughout, the impact is massive when students don't have these things. So the economic support for things beyond tuition like that, as well as even childcare, as we've seen a rise in more single parents going back to school or even going to school for the first time, these kind of a holistic approach to supporting students is big.
We're talking to Matthew Browngen right now, senior associate at COWS, a nonprofit think tank based at UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about a new report on ethnic and racial disparities at Wisconsin's public colleges and universities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this report? If you're a student or former student, what do you think would work to help address these disparities? If you're a person of color yourself, can you tell us about your experience at a technical college or university here in Wisconsin? And if you're on the other side of things, if you work at in the university system, the technical college system, what do you see going on? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we continue our conversation about racial and ethnic disparities at Wisconsin's public colleges and universities and what could be done to remedy some of those gaps. Matthew Browngen is with us, senior associate at the group COWS based at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What changes would you like to see, if any, in Wisconsin's higher education system to address these disparities in the number of the percentage of high school graduates from different ethnic and racial backgrounds who go to college and who then graduate from college? If you've been a student recently or you work in the university or technical college system, what issues do you see? What efforts do you see out there to try to fix some of these things? What questions do you have about our guest report? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Matthew, another big recommendation in your report has to do with UW-Milwaukee in particular. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so UW-Milwaukee, one of our big and I guess key findings within that is the consistently low graduation rates at UW-Milwaukee, which is troublesome. When we look at, and I like to, at COWS, what we like to talk about is high-road policies, particularly when it comes to public spaces. So we're not really of the mind of, oh, this school's performing bad, so let's, you know, or this institution performing bad, so let's divest from it. It's more so investigation of what's going on. So with UW-Milwaukee, really graduation rates are low across the board, with overall white students are graduating around 45%. The national average is a little over 60% when it comes to graduation rates. To highlight, as far as raw numbers, when it comes to six-year graduation rates, right now, 1,188 white students graduated from UW-Milwaukee that entered in 2010. Now, that's compared to 84 Latino students and 64 black graduates. 64 from UW-Milwaukee graduated with a six-year graduation rate that entered in 2010. Now for reference point, roughly, I think about, I looked at the numbers, 65 students from black students from East High School graduated last year. So, you know, we know Madison is not that diverse. I mean, compared to the rest of the state, sure, but overall, not really. So that's really troublesome. So when it comes to our recommendation around Milwaukee, it is absolutely a targeted investment into UW-Milwaukee. This is we see it as a cornerstone institution, a cornerstone school within the state, since it is, you know, in our most ethnically and racially diverse city, our largest city. It's seen and serves really as a you know, community college, not in the traditional, you know, technical sense, but it still serves the community itself.
Right. The phrase access school,
right,
I think, is one. It's both a research institution, but also this access,
absolutely,
school for a diverse community is,
yeah,
what it's intended as.
Yeah. And, you know, these graduation rates are really troublesome, particularly when you, again, think about the future of the Wisconsin economy. As we talk about a change state and state demographics, this school has increasing importance when it comes to providing economic opportunity for our most diverse populations within the state. So it's really, you know, they need support, they need money, they need to have the resources to properly invest in their students.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in Sussex. Paul, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Paul?
I just think that it's wrong to artificially force diversity. I think the problem stems from problems that we have in our inner cities and our inner city schools. We need to start earlier and prepare the students for further schooling instead of artificially doing it.
Paul, thanks for the call. So is Paul saying the solution is upstream? Kids need to come out of public school or private school, for that matter, better prepared for college.
I mean, as I said earlier, you know, our K-12 system needs you know, just as much investment as the post-secondary system. But when it comes to graduation rates, you know, that's on the institutions themselves. That's they already have them. You know, access is one thing, and institutions can, post-secondary and public universities can take a part in access, particularly when it comes to pre-college programs. You know, at the same time, it's not forcing diversity. It's about providing equal access to economic opportunity. And what we see when it comes with these institutions, and I'm, you know, I'll throw in even our K-12 system. We know our black and brown students are receiving less support in a lot of different ways. And I'm thinking really even holistically, we know housing, we know food, security plays a big role when it comes to being able to perform well in school. And we know within our state, when it comes to economic opportunity, are some of our most hardest hit, you know, when it comes economically, families are going to be families of color. So then all, you know, our inability to have these families and you know, students be able to be housing and food secure will impact their ability to perform in school and their kids' ability to perform in school. So then it just helps really feed the cycle. So this is a spot where the state of Wisconsin can invest and help interrupt that cycle while providing economic opportunity for families as they, you know, kind of go and form in the workforce.
Paul, thanks for that call. We're talking to Matthew Browngen, Senior Associate at COWS, a nonprofit think tank based at UW-Madison, talking about a report he co-authored on ethnic and racial disparities in Wisconsin's public colleges and universities. Matthew, I want to talk about the idea of the first generation college student, people,
yeah,
who have parents who went to college they've got that kind of institutional memory in their family. You know how to apply for college.
Yeah.
It's on your radar. How important is it, especially for diverse communities, to get that first generation in there, and then maybe that leads to the second and third generation?
Right. That's huge, and it's where programs like UW-Madison's People Program really play in helping students. And this is really where a key aspect of pre-college programs plays into it, is helping students and helping families that might not be familiar of really how to navigate the entire process of applying for college, of navigating the financial systems to get support, of navigating the counseling systems and the advising system. Like, it's overwhelming for a lot of families. So that's where pre-college programs really step into play. And then, you know, as you mentioned, this helps interrupt these intergenerational cycles of poverty. It's you know, one piece of a larger puzzle, but it's a very important piece, particularly when it comes to wages within a person's life.
And some people talk about, well, maybe college isn't worth it. It doesn't pay off in the long run. You start off the report looking at some of the, I guess, the bonus in long-term salaries for college education. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to wages and what we're looking at, you know, less than high school, you're looking at $11 an hour within Wisconsin. You're looking at $15.23 an hour for high school. Some college, no degree, you're looking at $15.97. Now, when it comes to an associate's degree, you're already adding a little bit more. You're looking at, you know, close to $19 an hour. With a bachelor's degree or higher, you're looking at $26 an hour. You know, these things are important when it comes to the well-being of families and the capability to provide for your family. You know, these folks, regardless, you know, they put in a lot of work. And we see, again, it's one piece of a larger puzzle. But access to you know, some sort of post-secondary degree absolutely makes it easier for somebody to provide for their family.
I want to flip things around. There's a lot of talk about higher tech manufacturing jobs, obviously the Foxconn development getting a lot of attention. How important is this from the workforce point of view, having people from southeastern Wisconsin, say, in particular, to fill these jobs as they're created?
Yeah, I mean, this is where our technical schools really come into play as well. And why they need investment when it comes to recruiting, bringing in, and seeing through completion our growing diverse population, really anybody, but particularly our families of color, when it comes to these technical jobs. And as our economy starts to shift away, and it'll probably increasingly do so from you know, certain aspects of old industrialized labor to something more technical or even more green, these schools are going to be increasingly important.
As we wrap up, Matthew, you've got this report out. Are people buying what you're selling? Do you think there's that people are listening to the case you're making?
You know, I hope so. And really, you know, I guess it depends if you believe in the value of public institutions. And, you know, we from COWS definitely have a deep belief in the value to society of public institutions. And we see when we invest, and through a variety of reports we've done in the past, when we invest in our public institutions, we see really a rise in the standard of living of everybody.
We'll leave it there. Matthew, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Browngen is a senior associate at COWS, a nonprofit think tank based at UW-Madison. He joins us today to talk about a new report he co-authored on ethnic and racial disparities in Wisconsin's public colleges and universities, and how these institutions can try to close those gaps.